You may be right. You are listening to The Morning Edge on 1490 AM, and here is your host, Augie.
Good morning, Tampa Bay. Oh, my golly. Do you trust your government? Do you trust the water you drink? Oh, my golly gee whiz. And do you trust your mayor? I mean, and you trust your police. Who do you trust? Governor Rick Snyder in Michigan knew a year ago that he was switching water to the Flint River, and the children of Flint, Michigan were drinking it. And, of course, it was loaded with lead. You know, shoot people with lead, now you feed it through their gullet and they drink it. And your children are brain dead early on in life from the lead that they take, if they take sufficient amounts, and it doesn't take much, they say. In any event, he knew a year ago, doctors were warning him what he was doing was illegal, among other things, if not unethical. And why isn't he going to go to jail? Good question. Anyway, we're supposed to have Dennis Mealy on the show this morning in studio, but short of that, he's going to be talking about the impact fees with respect to the county and of Manatee and what that's going to do, alleviating the cost for developers but loading up the cost for citizens relative to the schools. On Thursday, Manatee County Commission broke out its well-worn rubber stamp to help developers push their half-off impact fees safe across the finish line. The board approved the Manatee School District's ill-conceived recommendations to replace only 50% of the fees that were recommended in a recent taxpayer-funded study, following 6 years of collecting no fees whatsoever. And, of course, when they build all these new houses, the infrastructure has to be built by somebody, and if it doesn't go in by the developers, guess what you get to pay for out there. Don't you love that, Mr. Baruff and Mr. Neal? And those developers get off scot-free from that cost. The roads, all of the sewer systems, all of that, you get to pay for. Lovely situation. I bet Dennis, if he comes in or calls, will be discussing that with us, among other things. The other thing that's on a national basis that you should be concerned about, I think, how long will Iran ignore what Saudi is doing? And Riyadh, which is where Iran's capital really operates out of, is really the culprit here. And, of course, the 9/11 didn't happen without Saudi involvement. And the latest effect of Saudi involvement, Floyd, is what they do to us and internationally in the Middle East and what they do to oil prices. Saudi is driving the price down. Your gas prices are going to go down. They're going to go down even lower because we're in a price war, and a sectarian price war. And you're going to see the price of oil drop. Right now it's at around 30 bucks a barrel, maybe a little more, but it's going to probably fall to 10 bucks a barrel. They're trying to break the bank of, first of all, Iran at 100 bucks a barrel, their cost, Russia at 100 bucks a barrel or thereabouts, Venezuela, the same thing. In the United States, our frackers are at about 100 bucks a barrel. The only one that's less than that significantly is our North American neighbor, Canada. In any event, they're at about 45. So Saudi oil, it costs them to bring it out of the ground at $10 a barrel. So you see those prices go down, you can certainly decide that OPEC is really run by Saudi Arabia. And the latest attacks on Iran by killing off their imam and beheading him and doing the same business that ISIS does, isn't that a curious similarity? The ISIS does beheadings as a public protest to why everybody else is an infidel. You're losing your head, folks. What a bloody mess that they took over. But guess who sponsors all that? Saudi Arabia. And how long is Iran going to put up with that? And there's an article in the New York Times about that. And at the same time, how long are we going to leave the sanctions off the Saudis for the missile development? As the nuclear pact is about to be settled, and will that really settle with one nation exempting itself? That's the United States. Floyd, this thing is rolling thunder, ready to burst on the scene, I would say, don't you think? Do you have any thoughts on any of this?
Well, you mentioned sectarian oil prices, and it's an interesting concept. And so why don't you kind of elaborate on that?
Well, when you have one country that has 91 million people in population, that's Iran, and their oil costs, and oil, they sell oil too, are at basically 100 plus bucks a barrel to produce their oil. And their friend Russia has the same problem at the same price level. And then you have their enemy, that is the Saudis, who want Sharia law imposed on everybody. They do it in their country wholesale. The Saudi oil costs $10 to bring it, as I said earlier. And so you have a conflict over what Islam is about, and that the Saudis believe in the strict form of Sharia law, which some people think is a law different than any other law. In fact, it's the same as your Ten Commandments that Christians claim is really their law, which I believe it is not. The law of love and forgiveness is what Christianity should be about. But if you take on the Ten Commandments, you're acting like the Saudis, you're acting like Jews who follow the laws of Moses, which is what Sharia was evolved out of. All of your Ten Commandments have two little words at the end of each one, thou shalt not, or else. Your head is removed, your hand is removed.
Are you being stoned? But again, you mentioned sectarian, so basically...
The sectarian is that the Islam of Tehran is a more moderate version of all of that. They have Sharia law, but they don't execute people in that way over those laws. They have a more civilized, they educate their women pretty much as the West does. They don't force women to burqas. They don't force all of this upon them. And they represent the Middle East in the main terms of population.
And that's the point that I wanted to make, and I was hoping you would make. You did it very well. Iran is more moderate in many ways than Saudi Arabia. They don't have the beheadings. They allow women to go to school. They allow women to drive. And yet we have this part of the United States that wants to push for war against Iran, the more moderate of these Arab nations. And it's inconceivable. Why are we so much at desire to go to war with Iran?
I watched an interview this morning with Chris Christie, and that question went to Chris Christie about his... What did he think about Iran and Saudi Arabia, and who would he support? And without a hesitation, it would be Saudi Arabia for Chris Christie. Now, that is the people that conducted and orchestrated and directed the 9/11 attack. Those are the people.
15 and 19 hijackers came from oil-rich Saudi Arabia, yes.
And one came from the poorest country, Yemen. But we have Dennis Maley in the show here, in the studio, excuse me. And Dennis, you've been hearing this. I did mention the impact fees that are going to burden all the citizens.
Yeah, let's start real quick with what you guys are talking about. You guys are laying it out very, very well. My column last Thursday at www.thebradentontimes.com was a analysis of the current situation. So we have this execution of a Shiite cleric in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, so I kind of laid out the history with our relationship with these two countries and the two countries' relationships with each other. So the important part there is that a lot of Americans don't understand that Iran is the Shia capital of the Middle East, really of the world. So it's the only major country in the Middle East that has a Shia Muslim majority. And where the Sunni Muslims, which are about 80% of Muslims worldwide, a little higher, almost 90% of Muslims worldwide, are the ruling royal family in Saudi Arabia. Now, just like a lot of other countries, the Shia population in Saudi Arabia is oppressed, but in that western province where they're mostly congregated, that's also the most oil-rich portion of the country. So they look at it and they say, you know, our land over here is the one with all the value under it, and we're having our rights oppressed. Iran has historically stood up and been a voice for Shiites in the Middle East, in other countries, including in Saudi Arabia. So you had a Shia cleric, a Saudi Shia cleric executed by the royal family with you know, to call the case thin would be an overstatement.
No lawyer representing him.
Yeah, and there's little doubt in the Middle East that the Sauds did this to fan the flames and incite the Sunni hate. I don't know if hatred's the right word, but incite the Sunnis against the Shias, where they very clearly did something they knew we wouldn't want them to do. So I go into a lot more in the article about the complicated relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States, and it is not one of, you know, extreme coziness for that reason that Floyd described earlier. They are. It is harder to find a country in the world that would be more difficult to call your ally as a Western democracy with a straight face. As Floyd said, they lead the world in beheadings. They behead more of their citizens than any country in the world in terms of women's rights, in terms of you know, tolerance of any sort of differences from homosexuality on. This is a very difficult country to do business with and say that you're holding them to the standard that we do the rest of our allies. In fact, when you look and you say we've embargoed Cuba, but we do business, not only business, we do lots of business with Saudi Arabia, it's difficult. But the thing that, you know, Americans also have to look at is that there is not a Western-styled, aside from Israel, there is not a Western-style democracy in the region. There is no one there that shares our values, shares our way of life, that we have historic ties to. It is sort of a dance with the devil, so to speak. Not to use a, you know, just use a.
That's all right, Dennis.
An idiom. I don't want to get into the religion aspect of it because religion has clouded this so much.
Depends on your devil.
But you know, we do. You know, Floyd said this about Iran, and this is true. We've been, for whatever reason, despite no real evidence that you know, Saudi Arabia is on our side any more than, you know, they like us, you know, protecting them militarily, we've been so much more comfortable historically with Saudi Arabia, and there have been a lot of hiccups in our relationship, a lot, you know, including the, you know, the
we have hard
oil embargo.
We're going to talk about this as well.
The oil embargo.
Holly, welcome to the Morning Edge.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And that's all right. We have another caller as
we
well.
We have a caller about to ask probably Harley a question. Am I
right? So Harley, welcome to the Morning Edge. We're
morning,
speaking
Harley.
Here with Dennis Mealy. He is the main editor of the BradentonTimes.com. And Harley, what do you have to say about the topic?
Well, I just caught the last part of what Dennis was saying, but he's absolutely right. And the biggest, I don't know if it's an irony or crime here, is that we're continuing to provide bountiful arms to the Saudis, the U.S. and the British, as we sort of wink at them when we say, oh, we're going to oppose your human rights policy. The United States and the British helped put a Saudi official in charge of one of the UN human rights committees. So that's where you
let me laugh out loud on that one.
Well, this is where you go beyond mere
ridiculous
irony to tragedy.
Wow.
And you know, the other point here that should be made is that there have been efforts to bring the Saudis into a less barbaric mode. One of the most recent, and people don't know too much about this, but the son of the current king of Saudi Arabia has twice visited with Putin in Sochi. And supposedly he went there to get some guarantee that the Russians would keep Iran from attacking Saudi Arabia. But one of the things that the Russians said to him is, and this apparently got him quite angry, is that the Saudis have to upgrade their level of human rights. And you know, some might say, well, this is really quite funny coming from Russia, but the fact is the Russians are intervening on a different level against terrorism. And if you look into the whole Saudi role in supporting al-Qaeda, creating al-Qaeda with the CIA and British MI5, and then look at the role that the Saudis have played with the jihad in against Assad, what you see is that it goes beyond human rights violation. They're committing atrocities also in Yemen, and yet we do nothing. There are no sanctions. There's no talk of sanctions.
They're using our weaponry. They're throwing cluster bombs, which usually kill civilians, all over residential areas in Yemen right now, and it's our weaponry that they're doing it with, our label on those weapons.
Yeah, and this is where I think the American people, if they knew, if you had the wall-to-wall coverage that you've had about ISIS or immigration or Donald Trump, if you actually had some real coverage of what Saudi Arabia represents, I think most Americans would be more than uncomfortable with our relationship with them. And this is a Bush policy and an Obama policy. But I say that this, the media as a whole has helped the cover-up so that the official narrative from Washington has been able to prevail, which is that the Saudis are our allies.
And we have a caller here who wants to ask a question to Harley. Welcome to the Morning Edge. And your name is, please? Hello?
Good morning, caller.
Hello.
And your first name is?
Hello, caller.
Caller?
Are you there?
Yes.
What is your name, caller?
Yeah. Yes, I'm talking to you. What's your first name, please?
My first name is Linda, and I'm from Detroit.
Hi, Linda. Welcome to the Morning Edge.
You're calling from the land of the poisoned lead.
Yes. I guess I wanted to ask Carly a question. I had put many letters and emails and calls into my representative. My congressman is Dave Trott. And then I was pleasantly surprised that I see he's now a co-sponsor of House Resolution 14, and that is to declassify the 28-page section of the Congressional 9/11 report. And that report describes who financed the hijackers and facilitated the attacks of the original 9/11-01 World Trade Tower. And it was removed by the Bush administration. And although Obama promised it's released, he's kept it from the American people. So Bush and Obama are both hiding who is behind terrorism, and it points a lot to Saudi Arabia, as we were just talking. And the release of this information, it has been said, would have prevented the attacks on Paris. It would have prevented the attacks on San Bernardino and probably a lot of the refugees. My question to you is, why have Americans never demanded the truth about 9/11? Why do we accept, it was just something that happened, it's in the past now, and we accept corruption of our leaders and protection of our enemies?
Mm-hmm. Well, before answering your question specifically, let me just encourage all the listeners to fight to get Florida congressman to co-sign the H.R. 14, given that some of these hijackers were in Florida and the evidence of Saudi involvement with them is on the record in Florida. And so the fact that there is a bill, in fact, you have to have a bill like this.
Now, who is the congressman, Harley?
Yeah?
Which congressman in Florida?
Well, I don't know. Any congressman in Florida.
Oh, you're asking. I thought there was one that was already doing this. The one from.
Well, there is one. I think Grayson.
Yeah, Alan Grayson.
If I'm mistaken. But what I would say is that it's obvious that what Linda's getting at is that Congress isn't going to move unless there's a foot in their rear end. And that's the way our system, unfortunately, has to work, because too much of the Congress has been told we can't raise the Saudi question because they're too important to our interests in the Middle East. That's the line, the official line. If you really sit down and talk to a Democratic congressman, they'll just say, well, yes, we don't like the Saudis, but they're crucial for our Middle Eastern.
You know, that statement right there, Dennis was commenting on some of this earlier, but what is it that, does anyone here on this panel and the caller have a thought as to why it is that every time the criticism shows its face that there's a defense of Saudi Arabia popping up? Does anybody have any thought on that?
Well, I think that, the point I was trying to make is that there's not really a justification for, the relationship we have with Saudi Arabia and then the discomfort that we seem to have with Iran. There is, our history with Iran is much more checkered. I think there needs to be more focus on it. We've tried to, in our publication, really help educate our readers to understand, the perspective that Iran has of us. You go all the way back to, we removed a democratically elected prime minister.
And parliament.
Yeah, Mossadegh, who was progressive and secular and, was the kind of person we'd want to have as an ally in that region. However, at the time, our philosophy in that region was one of really puppet governments and who would acquiesce to American interests at all costs. So we gave them the Shah, and the Shah that changed things for the worse for the vast majority of Iranian citizens, and they've never really forgiven us for
Shah
that.
Shah of Iran, and for those listeners who may not recognize that, the Shah was a Shah of Iran, an American-imposed puppet government.
And that was done with
Mohammad Pahlavi, right.
Right, and that was done with the assistance of the
British.
Eisenhower administration, mm-hmm. and the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles being the brother and CIA. CIA head and John Foster being the Secretary of State during the Eisenhower administration. At the same time, the Eisenhower administration is building our infrastructure called the Interstate Highway System with 91% tax rates, which is very curious.
So they ultimately, you know, the Iranian people ultimately rose up. You had the 1979 revolution. They forced the Shah into exile.
Yep.
But, it, you know, and not terribly unlike the Arab Spring in recent years, in that you had a power vacuum created then,
yep.
and that's when you got the Ayatollah Khomeini. That's when you got...
Well, the reason Iran would not deal with us is that we tried to force them to take our side. They had said, we want to be like India. We want to be neutral.
Mm-hmm.
We want to sell to who we want to sell to and not be forced to sell to anyone. We jailed Mossadegh. We disbanded their parliament. I mean, Linda, do you listen online from Detroit?
Yes. The thing that disturbs me is that our administration went to Saudi Arabia as a side trip. It wasn't even planned to pay homage to the new Prince of Saudi Arabia. And it's almost like we belong to them or something.
Well, you saw a picture of Obama. You did see the king's hand being kissed by our president, Obama, which is pretty upsetting. And you do know, of course, that a lot of people are aware that the baby Bush of the family of Saud, I forget who the prince is. It's called
Bandar.
Prince Bandar.
Bandar.
Yeah. So something right
Bandar
out of Star
Bush
Wars.
He's known.
Mm-hmm. But you know, so I think part of it is that we're probably a little bit troubled that Iran is never going to warm to some of the things we've done. I mean, we backed Saddam Hussein in their 8-year war with each other. We sent
and
Donald.
And killed millions of Iranians.
Yes, sent
over
Donald
me.
Rumsfeld over there as an envoy when he was working in the pharmaceutical industry to sell biological. We already knew they were using chemical weapons in the war, but we still sold him the genesis for bubonic plague and anthrax to use biological weapons. You know, and then there was the airliner that got shot down.
The question comes in the New York Times today, Linda and Harley. Iran can't ignore Saudi provocations forever, and that is an article by Mohammad Javid Zarif. And I'm not sure. Let's see. He is
the foreign minister
of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So they're saying we're about ready. We're about at the end of the rope. You blow up our embassies. We kill our imams. You bomb our friend in Yemen, our poorest people of the poor, and you put cluster bombs there. Enough is enough. And if Iran, at 91 million people, plus what they can gather up in southern Iraq, Yemen, and Syria, and in Lebanon, and what have you, can really conduct quite an onslaught against the forces of Saudi Arabia. Where do you come down on this, Harley?
Well, before I take that up, I just want to comment on what Dennis was saying, which I think is really important.
Okay.
Which is that there really is no overriding strategic benefit or national interest for our country in continuing to support the Saudis. In fact, our national interest, if in fact we wish to have more secular, more democratic regimes, is to stay out of these countries, to trade with them, to try to influence them, but not to go in and arm them to the teeth and unleash them.
Well, I guess the question, though, Harley, is do we really want that? Because we tend to bounce that rhetoric around a lot, but every time we have an opportunity to have, you know, a little bit more westernized, progressive, democratic idea, we find out that they're much more difficult to control and to bend our way, and then it seems like we start to become more comfortable with, hey, let's just deal with one guy or one royal family that we can, you know, shower money on and hope they'll acquiesce.
Well,
so do we want democracy over
question,
there?
Which is, who's making the policy? And the fact is that policy is generally, as I've been emphasizing on this program for quite a while, our foreign policy is dictated by a coalition of private interests that go back to the Dulles brothers and others, which represent Wall Street, the financial cartels, the insurance companies, the oil companies, the raw material companies. You have this coalition of private corporations that exist above government that actually are directing the government. You see the same thing in terms of the fraud of the Dodd-Frank bill, the unwillingness to crack down on Wall Street after 2008, the corruption and fraud of the speculative economy that brought the economy down in 2008. They were never challenged. In fact, we bailed them out at the expense of the American people. My contention is that we have a government which is completely controlled by these financial interests.
Here's an interesting situation on that. We're talking about Iran. And if you just take a look at Wikipedia, just a common knowledge of Iran history, and the Shah of Iran, just take a look at the Shah of Iran. It says the Iranian oil industry was briefly nationalized. That is, they wanted Iranian oil for the Iranians under the democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, until a U.S. and U.K.-backed, United States and Britain-backed coup d'etat overthrew Mossadegh and brought back foreign oil first.
Because our contracts were very, very generous on our side. Right. And we had these leases that, yeah, for the oil, where BP and these other countries had very, very generous leases, and they said, hey, listen, this isn't doing much for our country. This is our resource. This is what we've got. And it was the first, you know, when you look at, look, now, cast that against Saudi Arabia, okay? So you look at Iran, and they were intelligently saying, this black stuff in the ground is the only thing we have of value. If we don't start taking that resource seriously and using it to develop infrastructure, to develop other corporations, other industries, in order to ensure that we have an economy in the future, we're going to have a problem. That problem they're going to have is the exact one Saudi Arabia has right now, which is outside of the oil. You have it's not just royal family. You have half of it, but then the courts and so forth are controlled by the clerics, who in turn basically give the royal family their power politically. So, in a sense, you have nothing going on except payments that are given to the citizens every year, to the subjects every year, and which are getting smaller, by the way. They're smaller right now than they were in the early 80s. And then free education, which is mostly used to get
the madrasas.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That is propagating right. This strain of radical Islam. So you have this example here, and you're saying, you know, rather than modernize, rather than diversify their economy, rather than educate their citizens in a way that is going to help them, you know, expand their cult, their society, yeah, and advance their society.
Give them their rights.
Yeah. Iran was trying to do that, and we stepped on them.
Right. And now, Linda, we've been holding you on, so do you have a final question for Harley or anyone?
No. I guess we need to put pressure on our representatives to protect us, because our government, our administration is protecting the enemy, it seems.
Right. There is a group called the Families of 9/11. Isn't that right, Harley? Terry Strada?
Yes.
Yeah,
the families of 9/11, the family members of the victims of 9/11 have been fighting this to release the 28 pages. Former Senator Bob Graham of Florida has been tireless in this, and his work plus the work that my organization LaRouche PAC has done along with the families is responsible for this H.R. 14. It's a simple point. Do we believe in transparent government or not? Why would we classify something that actually gets at a deeper truth to what's behind a lot of this terrorism? And so, to Linda's point, anyone listening to this program who wants to see a change and would like to see an actual, real fight against terrorism, this is a must bill, because it would open the door.
House bill number?
The H.R. 14.
H.R. 14. Well, Linda, there you have it.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Please call anytime and every time, if you would.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Excuse me.
So that was my point, Harley, was the fact that Iran was upset with us. that resulted in the siege of the embassy because we had priorly overthrown their democratically elected government for one reason, for oil, for special interests in the United States. Dennis, you were just talking.
Well, Dennis would like to. Harley, we're going to ask you to come back on next Monday, if you would, for the full hour, if you could talk about this and more. This is obviously an interesting situation for everyone, and we're getting calls out.
If I could argue, just make one final quick point.
Sure.
It's not just oil, because we did the same thing to the democratically elected government of Chile under Allende,
right,
which had to do with copper. So it's actually what Dennis was describing is an imperial policy where the interests of the mother country predominate over the well-being of the population that's being colonized. It's not the same as the British Empire in terms of the colonies, but in effect it is a colonial or a neo-colonial status that we're keeping these countries under for the benefits of corporations.
And there was Guatemala, the United Fruit Company, and we've done that over and over in the world for fruit, for copper, for oil.
And it should be noted that the Sauds actually did what Iran attempted to do. You know, we went in there, Rockefeller had the original contract to explore for oil in Saudi Arabia with Standard Oil, but they wisely, shortly after, made moves to take more control over that resource, and that's exactly what Iran tried to do when we stepped on them.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Harley, we love what you have to say, and obviously you have fans all over the country, and now that maybe we've become part of the same fandom. In any case,
keep up the great work, Harley. This is important. Like you said, we've got to get the American people aware of it, and like you said, if they have a better understanding of what's happening, it seems highly unlikely that they're going to be comfortable supporting this relationship status quo.
And you,
let me just tell you that I'm happy to find a journalist who's digging into this too, and let's keep working on it.
You got it.
And can we repeat this call from you next Monday for most of the show, not just part of the show?
Okay, great.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief commercial break. Thank you very much, Harley.
Sarasota is home to a true gift, the Posture Clinic of Sarasota, with Dr. Mark D'Amato. 4450 South Tamiami Trail, Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor, treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
With the animals.
This part of the Morning Edge is brought to you by Callens, Little, and Delgado, practicing personal injury, criminal defense, and family law. Call 941-749-1446. 941-749-1446.
I may be crazy, but it just may.
And we are back, and we have in the studio Dennis Maley. Dennis, I saw a picture of someone called Sullivan Bailey in the paper this week. Can you tell us about that, please?
Sullivan won the annual, there's a speech contest put on by the Palmetto Youth Center. It's a pretty big contest, and it's all countywide, and they do it every year around the Martin Luther King holiday. And it ends, of course, the big annual political gala in Palmetto every year is the King Dinner. And it ends with the high school and middle school winners giving their speech at that banquet. So Sullivan voluntarily, entered himself in this contest, and there are about 300 and some entrants, and they were written first, so then they take the 12 middle school contestants of those 300 and some that they picked from the written ones without hearing them say it, and they have them give their speech at the Palmetto Youth Center. That was last week, last Thursday night, and he won first place.
Oh,
and
really?
Won first place for the middle school.
Why are we not surprised?
And at only 11, you're competing against all 13 and 14
year olds. He reminds me of my granddaughter, who's the same way. They're quick on their feet, they're informed, and they care about information. And at 11, she was doing this at roughly the same age early on, and she's 22. But now, when they get into public adult situations, they speak as equals, not speak as child
right.
to adult nonsense.
So the contest was, take the quote, "Our lives begin to end the moment we remain silent." And he gave just an eloquent and passionate speech. You know, he has a lot of history and understanding of King. Of course, we just watched the movie Selma recently, and it was very, very proud moment for Dad. And he delivered a great speech. He's a great public speaker, and he'll be giving it this Friday night at the dinner in Palmetto.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I think that we want to say to the audience out there, if you wanted to call in, the lines are all open now. We've had a caller out of state. We had two callers out of state, and we'll be free to have conversation. And Dennis, you want
941-14. I'm sorry.
That's all right. 941.
My home phone.
941-745-1490.
I was about to get my home phone number.
Well, that won't help at all.
There are probably some unusual number of calls, but it is 941, as Dennis said. 941-745-1490. And Dennis, the impact fees and how the taxpayers are equated at the same level as the developers being taxed.
Yeah, we talked about this a little while back when the school board unanimously voted to recommend to the county commission that they reinstitute impact fees. However, only at 50% of the levels prescribed by Tindler-Bysshe, the expert consultants that they hired on a six-figure contract to study this. So it was very disappointing, and it was also inexplicable that the school board would be simultaneously, any administration, this came under the recommendation of Dr. Diana Green.
Of Dr. Green?
Yes.
Now, she's the one that was local before, and they kept her on.
Correct.
And so now she's...
She is a superintendent. So she made the recommendation. Now, it seems inexplicable because you look at it and they say, we have no money. We need a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We need an extension of the 15-year optional half-cent sales tax that's about to expire in 2017. You have to ask the voters for that by referendum. And they called this a fiscal cliff. If we don't get this, we will not even be able to deliver the basic expected, not expend anything, just basic services to students. They said, in addition to this, we will also need to ask for $150 million at least in new bonding. Okay, we've already got $500,000 out there, or $500 million, should be out there in debt. So another $150 million. And we need to ask homeowners to voluntarily increase their school property taxes beyond the highest millage that we can levy. So despite all of this, they said, but the impact fees, we're only going to need about half of those. All right, so impact fees bring in about $12 million a year. So over this moratorium, remember, they have not been collecting them since 2009.
It's for the last 6 years.
There's been zero school impact fees
going
paid.
On 7 years.
And
yes.
By the way, for this, you're talking about 8,000 new homes
yes.
in West...
This has cost $60 million.
Yes, in West Bradenton.
Now,
and parts of it, another 3,000. That's 11,000 new homes, new streets, new stoplights, new studies and all kinds of stuff, new schools to support that.
Does that include sewage and all that?
No, listen, those are different impact fees. School impact fees only pay for schools. So the other impact fees were halved, okay, back at the same time. They've been brought up and they're graduating to 90% right now. But we're just talking about the school impact fees for the moment. So the biggest burst of development we've had over this five-year period has been in the Northeast Corridor. Lots of new construction in Parrish, in Ellenton, all that unincorporated Manatee County in the Northeast part.
So all that has to be serviced.
There is no high school there, Augie.
So they're going to have to build more schools. They're going to have to provide police, fire, everything like
right.
that.
But the school impact fees are just for schools. So let's just focus on that cost.
Okay, sure.
So with the school impact fees, they're saying we have no high school out here. We're busing all these kids to Palmetto High. The bus ride keeps getting longer and longer because every time there's another development, there's another red light, there's more cars on the road. So you can only bus a kid so far, and that or so long, and now they're saying, okay, we definitely need a school here, and we're going to need another middle school out here, and maybe another elementary school. So this growth has not paid for the school infrastructure costs, but they're saying we don't even need all of it going forward. Now, what had come out during the discussion was that the developers had promised to support the half-cent sales tax and help them get it passed, which was much more important. So you look at it, you know, I'm saying that facetiously, you look at it dollar-wise, the half-cent sales tax will bring in about $23 to $25 million a year. Impact fees would bring in around 12. So they're saying, well, you know, look, whether it's 6 or 12, that's not going to do it for what you need. What you really need is a sales tax fee. Don't hurt us, and we'll promise to really help you get this across. What they mean by that is we'll fund the big pack. We'll send out the glossy appeals to do it for the children, support public education, our schools. We'll help you get this passed.
They'll do the propaganda.
Yeah, and the thing is, as Commissioner Charles Smith from Palmetto, who seemed to be really the only one to get it, him and Commissioner Robin DiSabatino voted against it. They're the only county commissioners
that's
who stood up for the
that's
kids.
That's out of seven commissioners.
Yes. Only ones that stood up for the kids. And Commissioner DiSabatino just gave a very articulate but very simple argument that, listen, there's a cost for every new rooftop that goes up. There is a student station that needs to be created, X number per every one, and somebody's paying for it. And if it's not the developers and the person building this new house, it's the existing homeowner, and it's not really equitable to ask them to do that, to subsidize the cost of this new world.
The new housing is being financed by the old housing.
Correct. So she said, I just don't think that's fundamentally fair, and I can't support it. Now, Charles Smith went one step further and said, listen, if you pass this, you're going to make sure the half-cent sales tax fails. I don't care, because look, I don't care what the what these developers told you to do. You can try to run this, but if you tell them we're only going to charge half, he said, I have kids that are walking to school on dirt. When it rains, they're walking to school on mud, because there's no sidewalks, and there's no street lamps when they're coming home from practice and stuff later. And I'm supposed to tell them, hey, when you guys go to buy stuff in the community, it's going to cost more, okay? But the developers are going to save money. Because I can't support that, but you're going to make it fail. And when you make it fail, then what kind of shape are our schools going to be in? And every other commissioner said, well, that's not really our concern. You know, we're not here to second-guess their budget or anything like that. We're just dealing with this.
Well, they are second-guessing the budget.
Well, they are. And here's the thing that came back. Listen, in 2009, when these whole things, this is the big game that's being run. In 2009, then-Superintendent Tim McGonigal gave a recommendation. They had just built really too many schools at the point, and they had not done it strategically. You know, they built an elementary school on an island. I mean, you can look at an island and pretty much know how big it can get development-wise because it's surrounded by water. So they built one there that's only 50% in use. However, they just built a lot of schools. They didn't foresee having to build one anytime in the near future, and there was a downturn development. And he said, I recommend suspending them for 1 year. But no longer, and he said, because if it's longer than 1 year, we could actually hamper our ability to pay for needed infrastructure. Well, without taking any sort of heed to that warning, the county commission just said in 2009, we're just going to go ahead and do it for 2 years. Because remember, the school board only recommends school impact fees, the county commission, and they're trying to walk back from this and kind of say, well, it's not really our decision, we just, nuh-uh. It is a county commission vote that implements them. So when the school board said suspend them for one, the county commission said, no, we're going to suspend them for two. Now, in 2011, the county did an impact fee study. Because remember I said in 2009 they also have their other impact fees. So 2011, they did a new study to say, okay, what do we need? For some unknown, unanswered, inexplicable reason, they didn't include schools in the study. So they told you, don't even do it for more than 1 year. You did it for two, and then you didn't even study it.
That was intentional.
Yes, because for every year since, you know what they said? Well, we can't because we don't even have a current study. So until we get a current study. Well, they kept kicking it down the road. Now, the law, and even the county legal department kept inferring that it was illegal, that without a study, we can't do this. The law doesn't say that. The law says, the statute says, you need to use the best and most recent data to create the fees. Now, if they didn't have a recent enough one, sure, the developers could have brought suit, but in order to cure it, they would have updated the study, and the study today shows, almost to the dollar, it cost what it cost in 2009 per house in terms of impact on school infrastructure. So that was an empty threat. That just kept getting repeated over and over and over. We can't do it because there's no study. Not true. And there's deliberately no study. So now we finally come all the way back around, 6, going on 7 years later, and say, okay, we finally got the study. Okay, so now it says you need them. So, okay, jig's up, right? It was a good run, 6 years. You guys saved $60 million. Nobody thought for a second, myself included, they would be brazen enough to say, Yeah, even with the study, even after you funded the study, taxpayers, yeah, we're not going to collect them. Developers really don't want to pay them. And that's the bottom line, is that developers set impact fees. No matter what the statute says, developers set them.
When your board members quote the developers' needs or desires or statement what they will or won't do, your folks, your guys are in the pocket. The people you're voting for are in the pocket, not of you, but in the pocket. They represent the developers.
Absolutely. And when you look at who receives the financial support on that board from the developers, there's your five votes. And then you look at who doesn't, there's your two votes.
Do you have the stats on that?
Do I have
the stats, statistics on that?
Oh, yeah. We've done that several times in our paper where we've shown the financial contributions from the developers, from Drew, from Pat Neal.
That's all public information.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you look at this and, you know,
so
listen,
for curiosity for a listener about how much money are these people giving to the commissioners?
As much as, now you look at Betsy Panek, you look at her campaign, between the PAC that was funded and direct to her campaign, close to $250,000.
A quarter of $1 million for a county commission seat. That was district-wide county commission seat.
County-wide.
Quarter of $1 million for this. And how much does she make a year?
The compensation package is about $100,000 when you look at everything.
With everything. The basic salary is about
$80,000.
That's same in Sarasota.
Yeah. But she got a quarter of $1 million just from developers.
Mm-hmm. And then you have you look at Commissioner Bussell, there's a $100,000 campaign for the big sprawl, not countywide, but that big sprawling district that includes all this development we're talking about. You look at Carol Whitmore, there's well over $100,000. This is just in their campaign funds, no PACs or anything like that. And then you have Commissioner Chappie, $70,000 in a race against no one. He literally, it was a, nobody ran against him.
So why are they giving $70,000 to a guy without an opponent?
Well, first of all, you make sure when you dump a bunch in the beginning,
you buy their vote.
That's the point.
You make sure no one else runs.
That's the whole thing.
You discourage everyone else
they
by saying,
up front that you're going to be fighting.
Commissioner Ball right now, the chair, has $60,000 as of last quarter. You know, the end of 2015, she had $60,000 in her campaign already. You know, she had two opponents running grassroots. They had $800.
Is or isn't spent? I mean, there's a decision to spend or not spend that money. What happens to that money?
Well, they can put it in their office account and fund certain things from there, or they can donate it to charity. Commissioner Chappie got in a little bit of trouble because he did not. He paid a lot of it back in what were called winning bonuses to the people that were running his campaign.
He's rewarding people.
Yeah.
Wow. this is a huge...
But he got a little slap on the wrist. You know, he's given several times he gave $15,000. Eric Robinson, who I know you're aware of.
Oh, I sure
he
am.
Got one of them. Or he got two of them, I believe. Linda Sink got another one.
Eric's wife is one of the commissioners
yes.
of Sarasota. I mean, you've got seven districts here, which the district voting does have some degree of representation. How close are those votes usually?
Not even close. You have a race in which, even the district ones, you have someone with $100,000 and somebody with $2,500, $5,000, going door-to-door, trying to compete. You know, some of those, hopefully, you know, it's disappointing to see no one run in Commissioner Chappie's district because that's the smallest one geographically. That is most of West Bradenton and the islands and Cortez, where right now we're in his district. That's one that maybe, because it's smaller, maybe someone could run a grassroots campaign. So it was very disappointing to see him go unopposed. And no one's filed to run against him this time when he comes back up again.
Smith, and who was the other person? Banacki?
No, DeSabatino and Smith voted against him. Yeah.
She was a friend of Terry Wender, and she spoke out in behalf of Terry in the previous election. And the deal was that she was thinking of not running and having Terry run in her district, and then she would run at large if she ran at all. And they didn't do it, but if Terry had done that, she'd be a commissioner right now, a big voice for the people, and she's not even around anymore. So this the price you pay for not having people that represent you and the money is represented in the big money.
And the arguments they give, they say, well, the impact fees hurt the economy, they cost jobs, houses get too expensive. It's all baloney. There's been numerous studies on impact fees done. Mm-hmm. The Brookings Institute has done the biggest one, and they've shown that it actually helps the local economy. It provides stability and investment for land. It puts a little bit of cost on raw land, right? Because it's more valuable when you know that the money will be available for the services to bring the infrastructure out to the development. So
there's been word, and this is a real point you're making, I think, and that is the land becomes more valuable, therefore a little less likely to be developed in some cases. And the argument has been, put in all the development you can along I-75. We do not want rail. The long range goal of these Florida developers, it's better for us to have boom and bust and tie up all the land parallel to the interstate highway systems than to have the rail system.
And what people don't understand is the real cost of developing these rural hamlets out east. When you look at it, and this is something we got to get better at too, from a planning perspective, we make it very hard to develop in the urban core. Mm-hmm. You know, we say you got to do parking garages, you've got to do all these things that are more expensive, and it really incentivizes that if I want to open a big box store or a supermarket or anything, we'll just go out west. Or out east, excuse me, where you can do retention ponds and drainage ditches, the land is cheaper, and just build it and put parking lot as far as you can see. However, just remember the things, look at runoff, look at our water problems here in Florida. Every bit of green, swampy grass that we put gravel over, that's one more place where rainwater cannot return in the water cycle back to our aquifer. And it makes it, and what happens, the more concrete we put in, the more of it finds its way into Tampa Bay.
The county with the greatest amount of peat moss, or what's the word, another word for that? I can't think what the name of that is. But Swift Mud has said long ago, Sarasota County, which is that, has the greatest runoff. So now when you add to that what you're talking about, now you have a desert form. And the peninsula of Florida fundamentally is a desert.
And then what we're doing on the inside of it with all the phosphate mining.
Exactly.
So then in that, that Bone Valley, where you look over, it looks like a moonscape when you fly over parts of it, right? You look over that, in the north, up in Duet in Manatee County, which most Manatee County residents have never been to because there's no reason to go to if you're not going specifically to someone's house. But they just, on the same meeting, the Mosaic Company got a an expansion of their Four Corners mine, which is in four counties, including Manatee, mostly in Hillsborough. But there is another area where we're pumping a million gallons of water per site out of the ground to force it down, similar to fracking, to get
so
this out.
The day is rapidly arriving when the salt water from the sea will migrate inside.
Salt water intrusion is already the number one loss of water right now, and it's the biggest long-term threat. Swift Mud will tell you that. It's the biggest long-term threat to Florida's water supply, and we are doing nothing to stop it. Between the development and the phosphate mining, we're exacerbating these problems, and we're putting tremendous pressure on our long-term water supplies. That will be, in the 40-year window, that will be Florida's biggest challenge.
Well, Dennis, this has been great. I think the panel approach to this show, I think, gives a dimension that is to be appreciated. I think actually, if you could come in on Monday on a routine basis and be part of this kind of a panel approach, even though Harley will be the major contributor, you can, of course, we can talk local stuff as well, but we can do that in another show as well. This impact fee thing is a joke. You've got in Sarasota, you got Benderson now. You really only have one, and here you got Baruff and Neal, and they're killing these counties. And it's just with the new voting districts, I think is going to maybe dent that. I'm not sure. In the I-4 corridor going Hispanic. So, but Dennis, thank you so much, and thank you, Floyd, and we will.
Thank you, Lyndon. Thank you, Harley.
And we will talk. Harley, thank you. And on Friday, we're going to have Johannes Werner, and he'll be on talking about Germany. He's calling from Germany, from Freiburg, and he'll be talking about Cuba at the same time, as well as the immigration situation in Germany. So it'll be quite a show. But anytime you want to call in, do that.
Keep up the great work, guys.
No, thank you.